Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello everyone and welcome to The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times, and the Six Nations has begun. Storylines all over the place, and to pick through all of them we've got a crack team as ever. Joining me on my left is Alex Lowe, rugby correspondent of The Times.
How did you spell that?
A crack team.
Crack team. Good. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Could be crack with an I if it's Irish, I suppose.
It will be.
Yeah.
Hello Will, how are you?
I'm very good, yeah. And also here is Stephen Jones, rugby correspondent, long-term rugby correspondent of the Sunday Times. Steve, you well as well?
Yes, fellas. Nice to talk to you again.
Very good. Right, so we were all at Twickenham on the weekend, and we will delve into it in serious detail in a minute, but your initial reaction, has that changed over the last few days, Alex?
It has a bit. On rewatching it on Sunday morning, you see things that on the day you didn't quite see. I left with a sense of optimism for England, even in defeat, because there were bits that were improved from the autumn. And I think that's the key thing. It's like the level from which they're starting on was very low and they were better, but they lost. And then I think watching it back, you start to identify the reasons that they lost or the reasons that they didn't kick on and win the game. And they're the things that end up standing out to you. Whereas on the day, it was an intoxicating game. It was a brilliant game. Scotland contributed wonderfully to it in a perfect sort of away day performance. Their execution was superb. The atmosphere was back. There was a real buzz around the place. So people left having been treated to a great game, and we saw improvements in England. So on Saturday night, it felt sort of uplifting in a little way. And then on Sunday, as I went through it, you see all the reasons why it didn't work, and then kind of reality hits a bit deeper.
Yeah. How did the reality hit for you, Steve? What did you make of that opening Six Nations as a whole?
I left, like Alex, I left Twickenham in good heart, chiefly because I'd arranged to see you guys and Slotty for a drink. Slotty told me he was going to be in Barnes, and was it okay to go there? So I drove all the way to Barnes, then found that you guys were in St. Margaret's. So the atmosphere of optimism I left with was disappointing.
But done like a kipper.
I agree with Alex. You are caught up in the excitement of a game, and quite right. It's our job to report on atmosphere as well as all the technical stuff. But when you watched it again, I was a little bit more cagey about, you know, oh God, here's the England revival, than I was. I just think it's a much better atmosphere for the players, and that comes down from the coach. But when Steve Borthwick said, you know, this England team, they didn't do anything well, you could kind of see where he was coming from. I'm not saying they didn't do anything well, because they did, but there is a heck of a way to travel, Lance.
Yeah, it shattered the whole new coach bounce thing straight away, didn't it?
Well, we'd been watching Sean Dyche's Everton beating Arsenal in the media room beforehand, and then we saw Wales getting thumped by Ireland. And then there was a bounce, to be fair, to some of what England did. There was a discernible improvement from the autumn, but just not quite enough.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get into all of it in full detail, as you'd expect. We'll look back on the action, including big wins for Ireland and Scotland. And also, nice to have a special guest from Italy. The scrum half, Stephen Varney, is going to join us to talk about their narrow defeat home to France and look forward to them playing against England on Sunday. We'll preview those weekend's games coming up. A huge game in Dublin between France and Ireland, which is probably going to be the match of the tournament in round two. And as ever, we'll name our god or goddess of the week. But first, why don't we go into full snorkel mode, a deep dive into Saturday's round one fixtures. Right, so as ever in these days, we are going to focus on the slightly negative bits of the England performance, but we should give full credit to Scotland. Three Calcutta Cups in a row. They've done remarkably well to turn that round under Gregor Townsend, haven't they? That terrible record against England. And Steve, you were pretty complimentary of their performance in the Sunday Times match report. Finn Russell, the matador, was Stuart Barnes talking about today. So what did you make of the Scots to start with, Steve?
Well, first of all, something mental happened to them, or someone toughened them up, or something toughened them up, because I think when England scored in the second half to pull more than the score clear, you thought, blimey, I've seen all this before. Scotland are gonna be really willing and able, and they're going to keep on trying, but they're going to lose. To mentally find the strength to A, actually come back and win the game, but B, to win it by running from deep. And don't forget, you know, they were only one pass away on two occasions from scoring more tries from deep. So I think it was a mental triumph for the Scots, Will. The way the precision with which they took their tries and really went for it when they could have hoofed it was sensational. And I just think they got a heck of a lot from the sheer exuberance and self-confidence at fly half with Finn Russell. I just thought his choice of play was immaculate. And I think they deserved to win. And my goodness, it must have been delightful for the Scots fans in the stadium to see these guys bursting out of defence and finishing off the moves. Never mind if they all were all South Africans.
I agree with you there, Steve. I think back to that the attack they had where Stuart Hogg threw that pass just back over the shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And part of me then wondered, so we won't make this about England, but Alex, for this section anyway, Alex Donbrandt dropped the kickoff straight after the Ellis Genge try had put England 8 points up, and Scotland had the field position and took advantage of it. Then Stuart Hogg fails to connect with that pass. You think, is that their chance gone? And then they came from deep, and England again almost created a situation that allowed them to do it, but giving them the opportunity to do it and having them execute it in the way they did are two massively different things. And Ben White's try was opportunistic, but the first try eventually scored by Hugh Jones was started with a really smart line-out play that basically tempted Owen Farrell to run out of position in defence. He'd gone after Finn Russell a couple of times. Finn Russell had obviously had a few jokes with him, and he went after him again and pulled himself out of position, and then a really smart finish to that try. Just a great piece of execution all round from Scotland. The solo try from Van der Merwe, just a wonderful piece of sporting brilliance, theatre. England made each individual defender from England made a mistake, but he made them make mistakes too. But for me, that fourth try was the try of the game. It's not the kind of try that you can see coming from 55 metres out, so Twickenham's on the edge of their seat, on their feet. As you say, Steve, the execution of it from Finn Russell receiving the ball in his own 22, sort of almost drawing the defender on, playing out from there, I think 80 yards, 80 metres, four phases. But the way they then finished it in the corner with some outstanding skill sets from their forwards, and then Van der Merwe, who'd beat five defenders with his first try, beats another three to score it in the corner. That, for me, was the try of the day. And it won't be the one that gets replayed in highlights packages and all that, but it was an unbelievable team try with a variety of contributions from across the team that really summed up what Scotland brought, which was this accuracy and execution. They took their chances and so won it with three times less time in the 22, England 22, and all that kind of stuff that was against them. But fair play, like Richie Gray was brilliant on his, you know, on his comeback. Tui Pilotu at 12, how outstanding was he? But just the all-round skill set to execute that under pressure to win the game, having to come from behind, as you say, Steve, and with all the fatigue elements that come 18 minutes into a rip-roaring test match with, as you said, with a massive ball in play time.
Yeah, two stats I was going to throw at you. Ball in play time over 40 minutes, which could play to a possible fitness thing with England, that they were a bit ragged at the end. However,
Put that in context.
Well, yeah, the context of it was that the Argentina game that England played in the autumn, the ball in play time was down at 29.9 minutes, and the South Africa match, which you might expect was even lower than that, 28.2. So they're basically playing 12 more minutes of rugby on Saturday than they did in the autumn, which is a lot.
That's a lot.
The second stat, you mentioned that Richie Gray pass, the flick on. So the company that you might have all seen in the that pops up in the top left-hand corner of the screen sometimes, Sage. They measure the smart ball stats, and one of the ones they've got is reload time, which is how long the ball was in someone's hands before they flicked it on. And that Richie Gray pass apparently was in his hands for 0.2 seconds, which was the quickest reload of the match, and it created the try. So incredible skill level, isn't it? But one thing I want to do is get into the poorness of the England bits and pieces. And we were just sitting downstairs in the office, Alex, and talking about the weird propensity England have with experienced players not to be able to close out games. Just looking at the side that was on the field at the end of the game, they've got Dan Cole, 96 caps. They've got Jamie Jaws, 73 caps. They've got Maratoji, 63 caps. You've got Makavunipola, 75 caps. You've got Owen Farrell, 102 caps. You've got Ben Youngs, 122 caps. Anthony Watson, 52 caps. And they have been a group of players who've been at the top of the international British and Irish Lions, European Cup winning sides, if they're Saracens players, for a decade, closing out massive fixtures all over the world. But when they pull on a white England shirt, they're unable to do it. And I don't understand why. Thoughts?
Well, Steve Borthwick, talking to him after the game, rightly made a point that the England team that he had watched last year had developed a habit of conceding early and more often than not struggled to come back. England did turn that around and put themselves in a position to win the game. But from 8 points up after 50 minutes and then 4 points up after 60 minutes after Dan Cole had come on and won that scrum penalty.
Welcome back. That was nice, wasn't it?
Splitting the loose head from the hooker with his first scrum for England since the World Cup final at home in the Six Nations with that amount of experience on the field, leadership experience, you've got to win those games. Now, you look at the last, I think, 13 games over the last 12 months, dating back to the Calcutta Cup defeat at Murrayfield a year ago. England held a similar lead in that game and blew it. They went to Australia. They held an enormous lead against Wales later in last year's Six Nations and very nearly blew it.
Mm.
They went to Australia and held a comfortable lead against the Wallabies in Perth and blew the game. Second test, they were 18-0 up and nearly blew it. There's a fragility to England.
It's a confidence thing.
Well, it's. I don't think it's confidence. I think because these are confident players. Aaron Farrell's doesn't lack in confidence.
Not a shrinking violet, no.
It's a decision-making thing. It's an execution thing. It's
game management. I think also you've got to remember that, you know, the one of the reasons the Premiership has been so good is that it is so difficult to close a game down now. I mean, you get Premiership games that are 25 points up and they lose the game, etc. You used to be able to hold the ball in the scrum if you were superior, hold the ball in the scrum and drain the opposition and knock the stuffing out of them and you keep your points. But you can't anymore because the ref is screaming at you to get the ball out. You can't used to be able to drive the balls, but now, because they allow people to come swimming up the side, and they do, never mind what they say, it's difficult to do that. Also, I'm afraid I may be making the crime fit the punishment here, but England would not have lost that game if Farrell had been 10, playing like he does for Saracens. If Saracens are up, they will stay up. There was no authority between 9 and 10, or I thought Alex Dombrandt, who did his best, he hasn't quite got the power to pick up the ball and drive it and dictate from there. So I think that 8, 9, 10 is where you look to protect a lead, and that's where England were good.
Just before you jump in, Alex, on that note, I mean, the 8 thing's correct, because Dombrandt came off with 20-odd minutes to go, and Ben Earl went number 8, who's basically never really played number 8 for Saracens much, has he? And the second thing is, there are two little moments right at the end that Smith messed up, or three actually, that Smith messed up. One was he called the ball to come left about 70-odd minutes in and Crabbe left, and then got put into touch where he could have stepped inside and he had WP Nell in front of him. For Quinns, he might have done that. The second one was then a really bad clearance from Scotland. Smith is bang underneath the post, 35 metres out. And for the Monday Maul, I'm doing a little thing on this that if you stop the image there, there are four England players all pointing in different directions, telling him what to do. And the thing that he doesn't do, which is the thing that a game-managing fly half might do, a Dan Biggar or Johnny Sexton, is drop the goal. And at that point, they'd be 26-22 ahead, and they've wasted another couple of minutes of the game, and maybe Scotland don't have the opportunity to score that late try. And then the third one was Scotland have scored that try. It's 78-30 on the clock. England have a penalty, kick to the corner. And again, the smart ball thing says that he kicked it 9.1 metres from the goal line, not 5. England then throw to the front. It's Wales 2015 World Cup game all over again. Moore gets sacked. Doesn't get put into touch, but the Moore gets sacked. They don't go anywhere. Don't score the try. Richie turns the ball over. Happy day, Scotland, three in a row. Yeah. Anyway.
So, I mean, that last penalty should have gone to England, as it happens, but that's not... England can't blame that for the defeat. Steve's point is right. And you know, I think we should celebrate the fact that teams can't just grind out a win from 15 minutes out anymore by just holding onto the ball and going around the corner and going around the corner and going around the corner and taking forever, because that's a dull spectacle. But there are strategic ways of playing it. Now, if England had their time again, if Ben Youngs had his time again, he'd be kicking for the corner rather than just putting up a kick that no one chased. Twice that happened. Once was marked. The next time Scotland counterattacked and scored. That kick just goes into the corner and England chased better. Scotland are pinned down in their own territory. That's one way of trying to see out the game, is you just don't allow any space or any opportunity for a team to counter. Secondly, drop goals. I mean, we talked about it in... Steve, you weren't there because you'd driven to Barnes, but we talked about it in the pub in St Margaret's after the game. Why do fly halves nowadays not consider that as a game management?
It's almost like it's a bit dirty, isn't it?
It is, but...
Cheating. Points,
I'm thinking... You know, I mean, at the time, I was thinking about the Wales game in 2 weeks' time. Now, 3 weeks' time. Now, after the way Italy played on Sunday, maybe they need to do it next week. But what I was saying in the pub was, even go to Cardiff, the first three times they're in range, if they take a drop goal, like they would have done 20 years ago, God, 20 years ago, go 3-6-9, drop goal, suddenly there's a cushion there. Suddenly the onus is on the hosts. You know, the Millennium Stadium, Principality Stadium is quiet. The hosts have got to do something. It's a game management tactic that does feel like it's considered too dirty or too cheap a way to get points. And, you know, and maybe you don't win games just by kicking drop goals anymore. But if you want to control the game, if you're up and you need to just...
It's just easy points, isn't it?
It's just easy points when you're in the hosts.
It's the same thing as you don't automatically go for the 3 points from a penalty shot anymore. There's this hankering to stick it in the corner, and I think it's the same sort of blight that stops you dropping goals. But every now and again someone drops a goal and you think, God, that was good, why didn't they do that before?
I also think they're not very good at it anymore.
You're
right, I don't think they practice, but it's still staggering to think, and all our younger listeners would be amazed by this, the drop goal used to be 4 points and the try used to be three. I mean, how could that happen? That was even before my time, by the way.
I do remember, actually, on the Sunday morning after England won the World Cup final in 2003, I was at my sort of Sunday morning minis, and we had a whole game that was, can we score drop goals? And that was a sort of Johnny/Clive Woodward legacy. But yeah, it's a funny thing, isn't it? It's just, but going back to my sort of initial point is, I still don't understand, and Jamie George tried to take responsibility for this afterwards when he spoke to us in the mix zone and said, look, Eddie took the brunt of our poor performances, really, and we need to take responsibility. And I kind of agree with him. Like, there's plenty enough nous and cleverness in that team that it's just never showed. I mean, the years before I covered England more closely, I was with Wales, and that team that is now getting a bit old, and we'll move on to them in a second to talk about that game, had so much nous, so much cleverness, so much game management skill that Alan Wynne Jones is of this world. The things that they did to close out games, hardly ever beaten badly, and they stuck in and they saw games out and they just found ways to get through. Whereas England just don't seem to have that quality, and I don't know why that is, because it's not for a want of experience of big games or anything, because they couldn't have had more across the spine of the team, really.
I think we talked about at the top about how Steve Borthwick, after the game, having been tried to be fairly diplomatic up until now, basically laid it all out on the table to provide context for where England are. His view, his analysis, was that he was inheriting a team that wasn't good in any area. And I think where Steve and I came from as we walked out of Twickenham on Saturday was that there were, from that base level, there were some improvements. A, the crowd were re-engaged again. Who would have predicted that Steve Borthwick's words would be boomed out over the PA system?
Oh, voiceover, kind of
like
wasn't it?
Like a ringmaster. But there was a buzz about the place again. There was a pace in England's attack that had been missing. The speed of ruck, basically, the number of times they were to play away from a ruck in under 3 seconds had gone up by 10% from the autumn season.
It was obvious, wasn't it?
No, that was obvious. The carries were effective again.
Chesham, Ludlam, good.
Genge, massive, in a way that they hadn't been last year, certainly in the autumn. There were the scrum, There were a couple of issues early on. There was an overbalancing free kick and Genge was penalised, but then they won two big scrum penalties in the second half. One led to a try, one led to a penalty goal. That's 10 points effectively with their roots in the scrum. So as I said at the top, there was a bounce in some areas for England. One of the areas that England would look at Scotland and think, wow, was execution. But two was the way that Russell and Tuipulotu played. And that Will and I were sitting next to each other in the stand going, well, actually, this feels like it's working better.
Mm.
But again, on the rewatch, you realise that it's either Smith running the show and Farrell's trying to operate as a more traditional 12, appearing on his shoulder now and again, or in the next phase of the game, Farrell's running the show and Smith's often
peripheral, really.
Peripheral, drifting behind, because what Farrell's doing is putting these big runners through. They weren't operating as a partnership. We keep calling it the playmaking partnership, but
it was one or
that's
the other.
The big thing. Whereas Russell and Tuipulotu, there's a balance there that they played off each other. Tuipulotu's a big guy with skills, which is, you know, England. Whoever England play at inside centre is playing out of their natural position or the position that they consider themselves. Like whether they play Manu there, Ollie Lawrence there, Henry Slade there, Owen Farrell there, they'll be wearing the 12 jersey when they would prefer to be wearing 10 or 13.
Yeah. And that's a weird thing. I mean, you might be writing about this week, Alex, but this sort of the weird position of number 12 in Test rugby is sort of fascinating, isn't it? Where lots of teams either go with a big lad, but the sort of nirvana is the Tuipulotu or Andre Esterhazen type guy who's massive and has got good hands and can kick. And there's not many of them.
About, well,
yeah, exactly. That's the point.
About, so when in doubt, when you haven't got everything that you want there, you haven't got a 12 who is both massive and a footballer and a kicker, etc. You go with the big guy, no question. It sounds old-fashioned, but as Alex said, Tuipulotu was tremendous. He looked like a guy who knew what was going on around him as well. When you've got Finn Russell, who's an artist, and Tuipulotu, you've got a core to your team. Now, Smith and Farrell are individually decent players, but problem I got with Smith is he must be unbelievably difficult to play outside, because when he gets the ball, he very rarely goes steaming up and puts the next man in. He tends to do a big goose step, or he slows down to bring the defence onto him, and it must be really difficult to play there. Now, Farrell must play in the next game and for the rest of the season, because there's no point in asking Owen, although I thought tackled really well, there's no point in asking him to take on Tuipulotu in a strong arm contest. And it's unpopular, but until England sort themselves out, I would play Tuilagi in midfield in every game, and I play Farrell 10 in every game, because that's the nearest thing you've got to the genius of Finn Russell and the power and footballing of Tuipulotu.
Well, let's end that section off with a note about Scotland. And it's something, this is not me being negative, because it's something that everyone in the post-match mentioned themselves from the Scottish side is backing it up. Mm. Don't win one game, be really happy about it, and then screw up all the other ones.
They've never won games one and two.
He beat me to the snap.
I'm sorry.
No, perfect. So 2006, beat France on the opening day. Next game, Wales, defeat. The next time they won an opening day, 2017, Ireland. What did they do the next week? Lost to France. 2019, opening day win against Italy, lost to Ireland. And then the last two have been England wins, 2021, 2022, both times lost to Wales. And what happens next? They're hosting Wales, which leads us quite nicely on to Wales. And the new coach bounce, eh? That didn't go very well, did it? I mean, I was slightly late walking up the road to watch that game. And I came into our little press area and the telly was on. It was already 7-0. And then before I'd managed to get my ref link, it was 14-0.
Yeah.
So that was a terrible start for Wales, really. And they brought it back, but there was quite a lot of alarming stuff in that game, wasn't there?
Will Wales, if you'd sent them out with a list of 10 points, that these are the 10 things you must do in the opening 20 minutes against Ireland, they did zero of them. Didn't do any of them. They had to keep it tight. They had to get numbers into the breakdown, because Ireland were brilliant at the breakdown. Wales had a couple of unlucky bounces. Everything went wrong for them. And after that, they were always trying to come back. And that performance, that early performance when they should have been so much better, has given Gatland a huge, huge dilemma. And that is, does he, before the Scotland game, does he bring in the new generation and discard the guys who were sluggish, or is that too big a risk when you just didn't leave them all denuded? So that was exactly the first 10 minutes that Wales did not want.
All of this is fascinating. The same with England, but with Wales too, is in that we've sort of removed ourselves from this World Cup obsession by sacking a whole load of coaches on one side of the draw. It's that massive dilemma all these coaches have got. Is it too late to change things because you've only basically got three or four games of real quality before the World Cup starts? Or do you try it now with a view to being better in 24, 25 and onwards? And I know, Steve, your point is just try and win every single game. And that's probably the point that lots of people made around Eddie Jones and got too obsessed with the World Cup. But it's a nightmare, isn't it, Alex? With, do you try and move on this group that have been amazing for Wales and have won so much stuff, but perhaps are waning? But do you have the players underneath them to come in? Pivac's job was to do that, and he looked at it and went, talent's not really there. What am I going to replace it with?
I think that there are players who could bleed into the team over the next few games. There isn't time for a wholesale change, but I do think there maybe is the odd one. I was listening to Sam Warburton, our columnist, just sort of analysing that performance, and he was picking out small details like just how quickly Ireland reset versus how slowly Wales got up.
Work off the ball, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And that's not... That's
there's
not
no skill in that.
That's just... Ireland have built up this relentless positivity about their game that they want to bounce back off the floor and put in the next hit because they know they've got teams on the run. And that first half an hour was a classic example. They were going at a point a minute for 25 minutes. Game's won. You know, Wales never got a foothold and they were... slow. They were slow to reset. Who scored under the post? Van der Vleer scored under the post.
Yeah.
It's like
there's basically no one there.
Well, you know, and that's organisation, but that's also he's got to galvanise the team to be able to be in those positions.
Mm.
Now, I think Gatland is the kind of coach who will get a reaction, but I also think, and Stephen may would probably know this better, but I do think there are options there, and you know, I was amazed he picked. I know he dropped out, which is probably no surprise, but. Lee Halfpenny to start this game. It was like he was trying to pick a team from 4 years ago when he was last Wales coach. And I think there are players he could be turning to now who he might get a quicker reaction from. And maybe this was just a first team selection that he hasn't been there for very long. I don't know. It felt like he got some of his selections wrong, Steve. I don't know what you felt about Wales and what their direction of travel is going to Scotland, because that's massive for them now.
It is massive. Also, do you know what? I'm always a bit suspicious when people say, oh, look, let's be fair, the boys came back well in the second half, or they scored a couple of the last try, or they had the last word. I'm always suspicious of people who say, really what they mean was we got totally stuffed. But at the end, we never gave up. Well, what's the alternative? Mm. Wave a white flag. I think that Wales will be 10% better. But again, you know, Scotland are an experienced team now. It's not the sort of thing that even at Cardiff you can throw in a bunch of youngsters. I mean, I'd say Leon Brown, Derry Lake, if he's actually not fit, Dav Griffiths, Chris Chunza, Jack Morgan at seven, Mason Grady, Hawkins. You can field a great under-24 team. But whether that does any good in international rugby, I don't know.
I don't think all of them.
Pardon me. I'll just say one more thing. In my heart, I would love to see Scotland make it 2 for 2 because they've been down for so long, and I really hope they don't mess it up this time.
The one thing I'm wary about to finish off that section is I reckon we had this exact chat this time last year. Wales rubbish in the first game. Scotland's on a high. And then what happened? Dan Bigger hoofed the ball up in the air, all grit and determination. And I think we had him on the pod the weekend after to say, well, that was a hell of a win, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But 2 points to finish off that quickly. Is it actually better for Wales to lose next week? Because if they win and paper some cracks over like they did last year, nothing really gets solved. Or the flip of that is if Scotland then lose again, do you just go, well, what was that all about?
It's never better to lose.
No,
I don't believe
not
the kind of jitters more. You maybe you do learn more in defeat, but as we've said repeatedly on this pod and in our paper, test match rugby is about when you've got to win. So it's never better to lose. I do think that what this championship is throwing up is just how fascinating the narrative is, and how anyone can
absolutely
beat anyone, which is exactly where we want the game to be. You know, Scotland beating England.
Absolutely.
We've got next week. We've got the world's top two teams going at each other in the Six Nations, which I don't think's ever happened before. The championship is brilliant because we all came into it thinking, well, England have got if England can beat Scotland, then they've got Italy at home, and then Wales away, who aren't in great shape. And actually, this championship is unfolding for them really nicely. They lose to Scotland. Italy do what they did to France, and suddenly the whole thing's flipped. And
tricky game away in Wales.
Wales are in the same boat. They've got to go to Scotland, and then they're playing Italy. It's like, it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah,
it's what we want. And let's not worry about too much about what it means for the World Cup. We're now in the teeth of what could unfold as one of the great Six Nations championships.
Yeah, talking of great fun, Ireland-France 1v2 this Saturday is going to be amazing, isn't it? I mean, Steve, you'll be going over to Dublin. What do you have any idea who's going to win that game? Like, really?
I do.
It's a nightmare, isn't it?
I have an idea, but they've only got two choices, really.
It could be a draw.
Look, I mean, I think that France, when they were slow starting in Italy, up against a good opposition, of course. Not having Cameron Wachey there and Jonathan Dante, they are so huge. Those two boys, not only huge in terms of size, but importance. I think they'll really miss Dante at the breakdown and all the good things he does. I'd be very surprised if France can beat them. I mean, sure they can beat them, but very surprised if they do. I think it'd be an epic game. The atmosphere in the stadium will be sensational. It'll be another classic. But, I mean, I think this is one championship that's going to be won on home advantage between one and two. And Ireland have got that. Never underestimate Sean Edwards. His ability to stop teams, but also, what an epic game. It's the sort of game where anyone who's even got a passing interest in rugby is bound to watch.
Yeah, and we'll get on to the Italy-France game in a second with Stephen Varney coming on the pod, but France, in winning that, have now extended their national record of victories to 14, which, as we know, the top in the men's game, if you exclude the proud Cypriots, is England and New Zealand's record of 18. So if they were to go the whole way through, then they're on for a record. But then on the flip side of it... Yeah, well, exactly. On the flip side of it, Ireland are on a six-game unbeaten run. So somebody's O has got to go, as they say in America.
Yeah, I think Steve summed that up perfectly. It is a game that any sports fan should want to watch. I think we often get quite parochial in sports in this country, and particularly in football, we don't look at the broader global narrative. Well, here's one which is just, anyone who loves elite sport with high stakes, high skill, high drama, you've got to tune in and watch that game on Saturday, because it's going to be brilliant.
Right, so perfect. That's going to be a great game. But before we get on to thinking about next weekend, we better round off with Italy against France, which is a pretty cool game in Rome. And joining us next on the Ruck will be Stephen Varney, the scrum half. Right, so next on the Ruck, we're delighted to be joined by the Italy and Gloucester scrum half, Stephen Varney. Stephen, how are you? How was that last night? You must be frustrated in the end.
Yeah, really frustrating. Our boys, we did well, but I think, we could have executed a lot of things a lot better. We sort of killed ourselves, especially in our own 22. But, we're trying to play some good rugby. We're trying to play from everywhere, really. So, there's some benefits to that, and then there's also some negatives to it.
Yeah. Does it say a lot about Italian rugby at the moment that not just you guys in the team, who always would have thought like this, but everyone around the game and supporters and everything else are looking at you guys and saying, oh, you could have really won that, and almost disappointed for you, and looking at 23-29 and saying, wow, Italy might have missed an opportunity there. It's no longer sort of, oh, they sort of expected France to win.
Yeah, since Kieran's come in, we're trying to create an identity. We're trying to get respect from other nations and, the rugby world. And I think the only way of doing that is putting in good performances and, getting victories as well. Yeah, it's unfortunate about last night. I think we really put ourselves in a position to win that game, but we learn from it and hopefully be better off.
So Steve and Alex here, just take us into the team room a little bit and what Kieran is trying to do to build that identity. What does he want Italian rugby to look like tactically as well as emotionally? There's always been a lot of sort of Parise leading from the front and Castro. But what is he trying to bring within the team, build in the team tactically as well that you guys can take out on the field? What's your identity going to be going forward?
Yes. So our identity really is around Rome. So we're building like our foundations. We're basing it on Rome and the gladiators, Colosseum, and all that. So yeah, we're creating a good identity, and you know, tactically as well. We're looking to play entertaining rugby, which I think we do. And like I said, we play from anywhere really, but at the same time, it can kill us at points. It's just learning from that, and then, you know, gaining that experience going into the following games on when to like exit properly, etc.
How does that work? The Gladiators Coliseum stuff, is it visual cues or is it music, or how do you guys do it? You're not all dressing up, are you, as Russell Crowe?
No, we're not. But now we're just it's more visual cues, and you know, the foundations of Rome, basing it on, you know, Roman legends back in the day, and yeah, it's just. The Colosseum as well. We've got that on our jersey, okay. And yeah, it's a very unique thing. You know, it's good to be a part of.
So, have you had to brush up on some of your Roman history then?
Yeah, we've few history lessons in camp, but nah, it's all good.
So who's the leader of that sort of stuff on the field? Is it Michele Lamoureux, the captain? Is he the guy that kind of is your sort of lightning rod for all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I think, you know, we got a leadership group. There's a few boys in there, for example, like you said, Mitch and Tommy Allen and them lot. And, you know, they're trying to drive that forward. And I think it's a really good thing to create our identity from. And I think it's very unique and very special to be a part of. Rome is a very special place. We'll hopefully make it a very tough place to come and play a game of rugby as well.
And yeah. And can you take that on tour? I mean, you're heading to Twickenham this coming weekend, a stadium that Dan Cole himself described as the Colosseum of rugby only last week.
Yeah.
Can you bring that with you on tour? We've seen how well you're performing at home of late. Can you do it against England?
Yeah, hopefully. You know, all roads lead to Rome. So, you know, hopefully we get a good performance in, learn from our mistakes yesterday, and hopefully good. Put in a good performance again and see what happens.
Can I ask you another about Ange Capuozzo? Because he came on the scene the sort of middle of last Six Nations, ended up winning World Rugby Breakthrough Player of the Year. We know about the move he made for the try that won the game against Wales, and he scored another one on the weekend. Are you going to tell us that he's got horrible breath or something like that? He's got to have something wrong with him, because he just seems like the golden boy with everything going his way at the moment.
Yeah, mate, he is, to be honest. You know, he came in the showers after the game yesterday, and he had a Dio Sauvage shower gel. All the boys were using Nivea.
Operating on a different level.
But yeah, he's another level, you know. Yeah, he's great to have in the team, and, you know, all credit to him. He's an outstanding person off the pitch and on the pitch. He's a great player.
We talk a lot about the game wanting superstars. It's how the wider sporting public engage with rugby. Do you have a sense in Italy of what someone like Ange Capuozzo can do for rugby in Italy? He's already had a generation of stars in the past. Yeah, Parise, for example, is the one we talked about, who maybe did have a profile outside of the game. Someone like Ange Capuozzo surely is the type of player who can bring Italian sports fans into rugby. Do you get a sense yet of the kind of impact he's having beyond just the rugby community?
Yeah, 100%. I think he's, you know, boosting his profile alone will boost rugby in Italy and in France as well, you know, or worldwide, even, you know, especially after that try against Wales. He's just absolutely popped off, and, you know, it's good for Italian rugby. It's good publicity. He's a good profile for Italian rugby.
So what are the keys then for this Sunday coming up? I know you've only just come off the back of that France game, but is it, yeah, looking to play wide again, speed of ball, try and test England out wide? Scotland seemed to have a bit of joy with that, at least at the back end of the game.
Yeah, of course, you know, that's our identity, you know. We want to play quick, we want to play expansive rugby, and, you know, I think other nations have got a lot, like, a bigger pack than ours, and I think we can utilise our skill set in another way, because, you know, our pack isn't as big as other nations, so... it's important to move the ball and move that point of contact, and yeah, hopefully, you know, be a good game.
Yeah. How much are you loving playing for Italy too? I mean, you're only 21, but you've been in the setup for 3 years now, haven't you? And obviously people will be able to tell by your accent that you're from Carmarthen originally. So you're really pleased you made that choice to go with your ancestors and the Italian links?
Yeah, 100%. The Italian culture has been huge in my life ever since I was young, being grown up to my grandparents who are from Italy, and, you know, it's just been a part of that culture ever since I was young.
So what's the next stage for Italy? Obviously, you got that amazing win last year. Is it, are you targeting a particular one this time, or is it build on it? One win, two wins? What are you looking at?
Yeah, we're just going to take each week as it comes, really. Focusing on our performances each week, and, you know, hopefully wins come from the back of that. You know, we were close last night, but it wasn't meant to be. But yeah, hopefully the next few games we'll get a few victories. You know, that's what we're striving towards.
Yeah. I'm trying to think off the top of my head, your Twickenham experiences. Have you had too many? You must have had one for Italy, but have you played there for Gloucester?
Yeah. No, I haven't played for Gloucester there. No, I've played once for Italy in lockdown, just after lockdown.
Okay, right. So with no crowd then, yeah.
Yeah, there's no crowd. So it'll be my first time in front of crowds this time, which will be a great experience.
Stephen, in a Six Nations Championship of anthems, do Italy win the title every year? Do you think Italy have got the best national anthem?
Yeah, 100%. You know, they're so passionate. You can see, even before the anthem, the boys are tearing up. It's a special anthem when you can see the passion of the players and also the fans.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to sign it off, if you were to beat England for the first time ever, what would that do for firstly you, and secondly Italian rugby?
For me, it'd be amazing just to beat England. You know, I think we've never beaten them, if I'm right in saying that.
Yeah.
So for Italian rugby, you know, that'll be a massive step forward again. You know, beating Australia and Wales this year has been a massive step forward, and then this will be another massive step forward if we win. Obviously it'll be a very tough game. You know, England will definitely be up for it after that loss against Scotland. So we know what to expect, and, you know, we just need to focus on ourselves and hopefully get a good performance. You know, hopefully a win comes from it.
Yeah, well, brilliant to speak to you, Stephen, and thanks so much. And I think everyone is pretty happy to see an Italian side coming back and doing great stuff, taking wins and taking teams close. So all power to what you're doing down there, and keep the gladiator stuff coming.
Yeah, terrific. Thanks very much.
Cheers, Stephen. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
That was awesome to hear from Stephen Varney there. And I don't know, is it almost too stereotypical that they're talking about gladiators and the founders of Rome and stuff? But that's nice detail. That was fun, wasn't it?
It was fun. I was surprised when you reminded me that he's only 21 years old.
Yeah.
Like, he's packed a lot in already. But yeah, they've got a big challenge. Big challenge at Twickenham. It was funny that Dan Cole, when he was talking before the Scotland game, said, oh, my son's, he's got twin boys who are 6.5, 7. They're just studying some Roman history at school, so, and they came to the first England game to watch him play properly, and he said, I've told them they're coming to Rugby's Coliseum.
Yeah.
The Azzurri may well dispute that now when they come. And yeah, the context, as we said earlier, the context of this game has changed, and the impression of Italy is changing. You know, win in Cardiff, beating Australia, coming as close as they did against France at home, like, it's not a gimme anymore. England can't, maybe it's good for England actually to assume that,
yeah,
to have to assume it's not going to be a gimme, but, you know, it raises that question in the back of your head that at some point, are Italy going to beat England for the first time?
It'll happen, it's one day, but it's whether it's this Sunday. I mean, look, I think the fascination that we will have watching it on Sunday is for a team that are clearly lacking in a bit of clarity and a bit of cohesion, the C words, and a team that have a bit of a ragged defence at the moment. One of the last teams you want to come across are Italy, who go wide to wide, and it's all a bit frantic, and it's Capuozzo and it's Brex and it's Bruno and all those guys going coast to coast. That's going to stretch this infield defence a lot, and the proof of the Scotland game was that England aren't very great at having any cohesion there, so that's going to be fascinating to see how they get.
Yeah, I think it's great for the Six Nations. It's so good for the Six Nations, isn't it? Because through the course of the championship, which we've been eulogising about, you get fallow weeks where everyone's a bit like, oh, I want a game. And you get the Italy week, which has often felt, for your team that's playing against Italy, you talk to any fans, it's kind of it's the least stressful, least exciting Six Nations weekend because you expect the team to win. So following England, you'd expect England to win. You know, if you're following Wales, you'd expect Wales to win, although they've stumbled a few times. But it's the, I guess, the fixture that historically has held
the least
amount
of
interest. The narrative and the expectation for this game now is totally different. I mean, I'm not saying it's on a par with Scotland arriving to Twickenham quite yet, but we go into it going, well, actually, there is something building with Italy. They're under 20s and under 18s have been really good for a few years. The Gladiators are on the march quite clearly. And
are you not entertained?
Very, very entertained. I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's brilliant for the championship, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
You don't have an easy beat kind of winning the or claiming the wooden spoon every year. Fantastic.
Yeah, and I'm hoping, as the person that predicted that Scotland would finish sixth in the tournament, that Italy go on a massive run. So at least someone else finishes sixth, because I think I had them fifth, but there you go. Stat to finish off, England have now lost all of their last four opening games in the tournament, although they've not lost a second one since 2009. And have only done so twice in the Six Nations since 2000. But 11 of those 23 matches in the second round have been against Italy. It's funny that the schedule, they always get Italy second. And so that will be the 24 matches, that will be the 12th. So half the time in the Six Nations, they play Italy second.
Valentine's weekend.
Yeah.
Honestly, every other year you go to Rome for Valentine's weekend without your wife, who's thoroughly hacked off at home looking after the kids.
Right, well, England against Italy is the next game, and then obviously France Ireland's going to be a massive in Dublin, and Scotland Wales the other one. So we'll next week on the pod go through all of those, but we better finish off with our God or Goddess of the Week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Right, God or Goddess of the Week time. Where are you going for yours, Steve?
I'm going for the ringmaster. I could go for Duane van der Merwe. Could go for a couple of Italians. Our man Capuozzo was there again. But I'm going to go for Finn Russell, the master, the maestro, the ringmaster with his top hat. I thought he was wonderful.
Okay, nice nomination from Steve. Alex, are we staying tartan? Where are you going?
I am going to stay tartan, but I'm going to head up to the coaching box because under Gregor Townsend, Scotland have held the Calcutta Cup for 5 years out of the last six. They've won it four times and drawn it once on his watch, which is a staggering turn of events. And it reminds me of one of our colleagues on another Fleet Street newspaper who wrote his preview for the first of these Scotland wins, saying, "You can't call this a rivalry anymore. When England win it all the time, this isn't, you know, it's the end of the big rivalry." Anyway, Scotland have proven there's no rivalry there by holding the cup 5 years out of six. Oh. I know Finn Russell would probably disagree that the miraculous comeback to a draw was anything to do with the head coach, given he just took charge at half time. But overall, in the world's oldest fixture, Gregor Townsend has performed wondrous feats for Scotland against England, so he gets my vote.
Yeah, perfect. Okay, so Gregor Townsend gets the vote. We've had Finn Russell, the Matador, the Ringmaster, and I'm going to stay with Scotland, and it's not Doohan van der Merwe, because I kind of agree with Owen Slot's piece, and if you haven't read it, have a look at Owen Slot, who wrote in the Monday paper of the Times that he thought he was arguing whether it was the worst best try ever, which sounds counterintuitive, doesn't it? But by the fact that England's defence was so bad, did it actually make it that spectacular? It was a hell of a finish. But anyway, I'm going to go for Sione Tuipulotu because he proved what a 12 should look like in international rugby. He had the guile, he had the hands, he had the ability to break the game line, and he was a perfect foil for Finn. And if Finn doesn't have him outside him, a lot of the stuff that he was trying to do wouldn't have worked. So mine is going to go to the proud Scotsman, Sione Tuipulotu.
Scottish hat-trick.
Yeah, Scottish hat-trick. Look at that. Amazing. Right, so proud Scots into the first weekend of the Six Nations. They're going into the next weekend of the Six Nations trying to beat Wales, which they haven't managed to do for the last couple of years. France, Ireland's going to be a belter, 1v2 in the world. England, Italy's got loads hanging on it as well. And next week, we're going to go through it all. But for now, that has been the first weekend of the Six Nations, and that has been the first ruck of the Six Nations having had a game. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll hope to have you with us next week. All the best. Goodbye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.